It is February 11th, 2005. My name is Peter Scales, a history student at the University of Victoria, and I am conducting questions for the Military Veterans Oral History Program. Could you identify yourself, sir?
Yeah, my name is George Foote, and I finally retired as a group captain in the Royal Air Force, even though I am Canadian.
My first question for you, you were born on March 29th, 1913 in Winnipeg. Could you tell me about your family?
Well, my father was born in Shaftesbury in Dorset, and my mother was born in London. And in 1910, my mother and father left England and came to Canada, to Winnipeg. My father was a compositor. You know what a compositor is?
Newspaper.
That's a typesetter. When they used to do it by hand, and he had a fantastic knowledge of the English language because it had, you know, spelling in those days was all important. Nowadays it doesn't matter what they do. And so, my brother was born, and my sister, and I was born in 1913, as you say.
And you were the third.
I was the third.
Of how many?
Total? Of three.
Of three?
Yeah. And my brother died in 1927. Mm-hmm. He had a leaking valve in his heart, which in those days they could do nothing about. But my sister died last year in her 94th year.
Had any of your family been military before you?
I had an uncle by marriage who had been in the RFC, RAF.
So you attended normal schools and graduated from high school in 1931. You were active in...
Not in 31.
Oh, not in 31?
No. No, but in 1930, well, it doesn't matter.
Okay. 30, yeah. You were active in Anglican Church summer camps and in Army cadets, and you were quite a swimmer.
Yeah.
Could you tell me how your background compared with other Canadian men who joined the Air Force in the 1930s?
Well, one had been a miner. And, you know, in flying training school, we had to wear a mess kit Monday through Friday. On Saturday, we wore dinner jackets. And on Sunday, we wore lounge suits. And he rebelled at this. And so he said, I will wear this shirt without having it washed throughout the whole of our training school. And he did. Henderson, I don't know too much about Henderson. He was, he came from Winnipeg like me. But really, we didn't get into Canadianism. We got into aeronautics. We got into flying, and that was our day, all day long.
Had the other chaps been athletic like you had been?
Well, we all had to play games in the RAF. We had to play cricket. We had to play rugger. And in the, I guess about after about 3 months, we said, look, you know, we're getting into your games, but we play baseball. And so we insisted that they get baseball and mitts and everything like that. And when we started off, and with the round bat, of course, the British boys laughed at us. So, I forget his name now. But anyway, the boy, the miner, he was a pitcher. And I was on the battery. I always was catcher. And so one of the lads said, you know, you don't have to wear a mitt behind there like that. So he was challenged to get behind and accept one of these pitches. So he did, and he caught it. And we took him to the dispensary and got his burns fixed up. And so they didn't laugh anymore.
No.
And so then they got into baseball. So we played all kinds of games. Wednesday afternoon was always sports afternoon.
Uh-huh. Were they all high school graduates?
Or better.
Or better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. having read your autobiography and concentrating, as this particular interview is, on the early Cold War. When war was declared on September 3rd, 1939, you were in flying boat training at RAF Station Calshot.
Yes.
On Southampton Water.
And I was the orderly officer.
You were the orderly officer that day.
That's right.
Tell me what airplane you were flying, and then tell me what the mood was at the station that day.
Well, we knew there was going to be a war. See, the RAF were very concerned about what was happening in Germany, and they were convinced there was going to be a war. Hence, they set up the Short Service Commission. They wanted to build up a reserve of pilots. We didn't have navigators then. And so they offered the Short Service Commission to the English boys and to chaps from the colonies, because we were a colony then, and my passport read, you know, citizen of the colonies. That didn't bother me, you know. Didn't bother me at all, ever. Just hold it a second there.
So what aircraft were you flying then?
I trained on... let me give it to me.
Pause this for a second.
Stranraer.
Stranraer.
Okay.
It was a biplane. Mm-hmm. It was built to the same operational requirement as the Saunders-Roe London.
Okay.
I had 2 months there. After flying training school, I had to convert onto the flying boats, which is an entirely different kettle of fish to flying on, you know, a land plane. I had to, of course, do oversee navigation, because the second pilot, generally speaking, did the navigation.
I see.
And he took over when the skipper said so.
True.
And like when I was flying out of Gibraltar with the flight attendant Jeff Harger, my first captive aircraft, when it was time for lunch, the boys would take the map off the nice cork table, put a tablecloth on, and provide his lunch, and I would be up in the cockpit flying.
Who would navigate then when you were flying?
Well, he wouldn't be all that long, because we were on a course.
Oh, okay.
You see, and we had a crew of five. That's all. So the one would be looking after the food, and the other two would be looking, and then the pilot looking, because we were looking for submarines, or else if we were, always looking for submarines, regardless whether we were just on patrol or whether we were circling around convoys.
So you mentioned that you were the orderly officer the day that war was declared.
I was the orderly officer that day.
And so was it a message or a radio?
We were advised, you know, right away. Well, we knew it was going to happen, of course. Despite the fact that Chamberlain came back and said peace in our time, we knew it was going to happen. So we weren't surprised at all. But what happened was we did have a gate. We never had a gate before because everything was open. So I was orderly officer, and I went up to check the guard, and a Rolls Royce drove up. And the chauffeur got out and opened the back door, when a flight lieutenant, Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, got out. And I was a pilot officer, and for the first time in my whole career, he saluted me. and he said, "Reporting for duty, sir."
Why did he salute you, the lower ranking man?
Because I was orderly officer, I guess. But it's interesting. First time anybody ever saluted me.
How did it feel?
It felt pretty good. Anyway, I told him what to do and to go down. So the chauffeur took his bag, and gave it to him, and he backed up the Rolls Royce, and off he went.
Was there a commanding officer of the station who had a meeting with everybody to talk about it?
I really can't recall. Because we weren't at all surprised, you know.
Yeah.
No, we were not surprised whatsoever.
Okay. Skip forward a little bit.
But I'm sure it came over the radio, too, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it's broadcast, so it came. Everybody sort of knew it. Mm-hmm.
In June of 1941, of course, the Germans decided to turn on the Russians.
That's right.
And in July of 1941, you were flying boats, and you flew a secret mission to Archangel in the Soviet Union.
That's correct.
Can you tell me about that mission?
Yes, I can. I was told to that I was going to go on a secret mission, and that I could only have a crew of five, total crew of five, and that I would not carry any armament of any kind. And I was told to go to Invergordon in Scotland with my Catalina. And when I got there, I was taken into a room, the door was closed, and I was introduced to five British diplomats. And then I was told that I had to fly these diplomats to Archangel. And the reason they used the Catalina was that there was no aircraft that could fly fast enough or high enough or far enough and all together across Europe direct to Moscow without the chances of being shot down were 90%. But the reason why they were setting up, they'd asked me to set up this trip, was because under the lease land agreement with the Soviets, they had to establish two missions, one in London for the Soviets, and one in Moscow with the Blitz. And so I was given some charts, and they told me that they didn't know whether there was fuel for me there or not, and so there I have to be prepared for that. And when I examined the charts with my navigator, we found there was no magnetic variation up in the real northern latitudes. So what we did, we had a sun compass put on where our blister, on the Catalina, there are two blisters. We had a sun compass where the machine gun would be mounted. And with this, we could take bearings on the sun, and then we would do it with our sextant. We would shoot the sun, and you know, a relatively simple figure. We got the difference of what it's 90 degrees out. Wait a minute. The sun compass was along the longitudinal axis of the aircraft. And so you got that as a fix. And then you have your compass as a fix. And you have the sun as a fix. And you have the sun compass as a fix. So from that, we established our variation every once in a while.
So you were flying over water the whole time?
Yeah. I flew... the flight was... over the Shetland Isles. And from there, we had to fly 100 miles out from the coast of Norway because we couldn't be caught by radar because they could send out the Heinkel 111s after us. And we didn't, we had no armament and our chances were nil. So we kept 100 miles out of radar, although we kept a very strict watch all the time. Then when we got up 60 miles short of Bear Island, Medvezhnoye Ozero in Russian, then we turned east. And then, keeping watch on the sun, we had planned our flight to get to longitude 37 east at noon. So we just kept on watching the sun. And when we got the sun due south, then we turned south. And then we made our landfall at a place called Torinoz, T-O-R-I-N-O-Z, in Russian. And there we flashed the recognition signal to the Soviets, and they said, come ahead. And then we flew across the Kola Peninsula, and then over the White Sea, And the reason it's called white is because it's normally covered in fog, and it was. And then we got the River Dvina, and down the River Dvina to Archangel, and we landed there and came up to a buoy.
So were you met by Soviet representatives?
Then a boat came out, mm-hmm. and there were, I think it was three, four Soviets came to get the take the diplomats off. They were very surly, and I recall very well how the chap who was the interpreter, when I asked him, you know, I said, look, can my crew and I go ashore? And he said, no, you can't. You're not allowed to go ashore. And it was my first meeting with Soviets, and probably it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
How so?
Because I said to him, look, I've been flying 19 hours, and I brought these diplomats here, and I'm supposed to fly five of your Soviets back. But if you're going to treat me like that, you know what I will do? I have enough fuel to go home. So I'll just turn my flying boat around, and I'll take off, and I'll go back to England, if that's the kind of respect you're going to give me. And he said, wait. So after they'd taken the diplomats back, then they gave us freedom ashore.
Do you think because you stood up to him?
That is the most important thing. And, you know, Churchill didn't realize it. Roosevelt didn't. They didn't stand up to Stalin. Mm. And you remember Khrushchev doing this, the Iron Fist? You see, the only way to handle the Soviets if they got you, you stand up to them. But what you got to do is you got to be slicker than them if you're going to work with them on that.
I'm sure we'll get to more of that. Not too long after, well, some years later, when the Germans surrendered to the Allies on May 9th, 1945, you were the operations officer at 202 Flying Boats Corps.
That's correct, yeah.
In Northern Ireland, doing anti-submarine warfare with Coastal Command.
That's correct.
I'd like you to describe...
My first squadron, too. The one from Gibraltar, originally.
Oh, and then you ended up with them again.
I ended up with them again.
I'd like you to describe what you remember about the Soviet involvement in the defeat of the Germans.
All I can remember really is them. They had come across and they were pressing well into Poland, I think, if I remember correctly. My mind is quite hazy on that, because we were awful busy. On that day, I had 16 aircraft on the squadron. We had 16 aircraft up. And I've always kicked myself in the butt for not having a picture of that operation board, because we had every aircraft in the squadron up to find the subs which had been told to...
the German subs.
The German sub to come up to the surface. And then they were to be escorted back in, you see.
Hmm.
So I don't really recall too much of that.
Do you remember any sense of, sounds like you were pretty busy on that day. Was there a sense of relief or a sense of disbelief, or I don't want to put words into
it? No, I was quite convinced that we were going to win the war. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all were. And those of us in Coastal Command, you know, at the beginning of with Coastal Command, I've got some. Just switch off a second here.
Okay.
You see, at the beginning of the war, we didn't have any really good long-range aircraft, and it was sort of a hit-and-miss operation, and the submarines had free rein. They just... You know, I forget how many, it was 141,000 tons or something were sunk. And when we started to get the Catalinas, you see, Roosevelt was very, very pro-Churchill, and he made the armaments available And so we got the Catalinas, and that was the first long-range aircraft we got. And so in 1941, there weren't too many of us, of course, we at least had a chance to escort the convoys. And to the best of my knowledge, in both 202 Squadron in Gibraltar and at Lockern, and 240 Squadron at Lockern, where I first got the Catalina, only one ship was ever sunk while we were escorting the convoys. That's the best of my knowledge. You know, it's possible that I'm wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, that only one ship was ever done. Well, it would vary. It would vary according to the job that had to be done, and particularly in relation to convoys. Now, you know, the convoys were usually running at 10, 12 knots. They had to go at the slowest speed. Because of the slow ship. So they didn't move very far in a day. And, of course, there weren't thousands of them sort of out there. So as a flight commander, I would be told what was to take place. So I would have maybe four or five crews ready, and I'd have an alternates. And then the day before that, then I would assign them in relative order. So I might have three aircraft up. I might have eight aircraft up, because there were an awful lot of flying boats in those days at Lockern. I don't know how many squadrons there were.
Were you nighttime flying or daytime flying?
Well, if you escort a convoy, and I'm talking about 1941, we would leave about midnight. And then we would fly halfway across the Atlantic. And we would pick up our convoy at first light. Okay. And then we would stay there until dark, circle. Boring, you know. Some of the stuff, you know, fighter stuff was all, they got their buttons undone. Ours was a long, hard grind. You had that long flight out with no aids. We had no aids. We had our drift sight. If you take three drift sights, you can get the wind direction and speed for your navigation. And we had our sextants.
How about the compasses crossing the North Atlantic?
Well, the compass was okay. When we got the Catalina, of course, we had much better compasses, because normally our compass was down below our knees. We had that magnetic compass, but we had the thing in the back and controlled, and we had an entirely different instrument panel. And it's interesting that the RAF in that had that same panel in every aircraft they built after that. So you could go from one aircraft to another, and that was the interesting.
The same magnet.
Yeah. Anyway, we would circle, and we had buoys in the blisters, and we would take turns, and we had to have a rest, of course, and we cooked on board. And then when it got real dark, then we would head for home.
So what would a Catalina crew do on sighting a periscope?
Oh, then you went into you see there. I never saw a submarine. Interesting. In all the flying I did, I never saw a submarine. There were hundreds and hundreds of miles, square miles of ocean. So if you did see one, you're lucky. Well, what happened as soon as you went for Lockern? As soon as we got across Ballykelly anyway, we had to go up through a pass. As soon as we got there, it was ERA. It was Ireland, Southern Ireland. As soon as we got past there, then our depth charges were put on charge.
I see.
Okay? And then if you saw a periscope, then it's up to the captain. You have to lower down, go ahead, and then drop your thing. It was very hit and miss. You know, we didn't get much training on it. And it's amazing how many were sunk. Later on, of course, we got what was known as the Lee Light, we didn't have any radar in those days.
So it was all eyeballs.
It was all eyeballs, yeah. Later on, we got a Mark II radar, which was better than nothing. And then when we got the Lee light, a chap named Lee developed this. It was a huge thing, a big searchlight. And we got the very sophisticated bomb sight and the radar to go with it. So as you were flying at night at 150 foot above the sea, 200 feet, and then the radar man will pick it up, okay? Then the bomb aimer will go on the nose, and then he would take over, and he'd tell the pilot, you know, I got the pilot onto it, and then they put on the light, and that would light up the whole sky like daylight. And then, using the bomb sight, he just said, go, and the pilot had the cigarette in his, on his wheel there.
It must have been quite a sight for the convoy crews.
It was devastating.
To see a flying boat on their side.
That's right. Now, a lot of them were shot down. See, what happened after, when something happened in the war on one side, the other had to compensate. Okay, so when we started getting this, I said, okay, if you're going to get us up on the water, like at night, you know, then we better put guns on. So you have to fly across the top of them and drop your depth charges.
On top of the waves?
On top of the submarine. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they just had their guns up like that. So a lot of the aircraft were shot down. Mm. But it became very devastating for them. Their morale started to go down because they had been out in wolf packs, you know, or earlier on. And boy, they were just sinking ships. That was having a field day. But when we got the Catalina really going, now the Sunderland was a great aircraft, but it had four engines, took a tremendous amount of fuel, had a much 12 on the crew, but it only could do 16 hours. So if you go out to the middle Atlantic, you're not going to even get back again, you know.
Oh.
You see?
So you mentioned that somebody's morale went down. Who's morale?
The subs.
Oh, the submarine morale.
Yeah, submarine morale. Then by 1943, I think it's quite fair to say, and I think it's actually in print somewhere, we started to get control of the seas. And it got better and better, and we got fewer ships sunk. Yeah. But, of course, this same thing happened out in the far east. And the same thing happened down in the southern Atlantic. Because we had flying boats down, like in Bathurst, for instance.
Bathurst?
Bathurst is on the western shore of Africa. Oh. It's now called, I don't know, it's got a new name now.
Okay.
Anyway, we had flying boats there. We had Catalinas out flying out of Madras and various places. Mm-hmm. And we had them flying out. Of course, they stayed in Gibraltar. But unlike the Cerro London, the Catalina could land out in the bay under bad sea conditions because it had what was known as a full stall landing. And you would come down to about 30 feet above, and then you would slowly throttle back and pull your nose up until you got just on the stall. Then you pulled the stick back, the tail went down, hit the waves, and then you came down and you couldn't bounce.
Sounds pretty dramatic.
It is dramatic. And we used to pop rivets. Yeah. But with the Cerro London, when it was bad out in the bay at Gibraltar, then we would land inside the harbor. Mm. And that was a little tricky, too, because you have to fly across. You'd come across North Point because of that. We landed there. It was because of the wind. Then you come across North Point and across the houses and the military installation, then drop down quickly and head for the opening. Oh. And you didn't have much room. So that was tricky, but it was fun.
All right, so my next question. Now, the Second World War is over. And in May of 1949, You were serving in the Royal Air Force Air Ministry in London, and a former comrade told you about the possibility of attending Russian lessons at university. You jumped at the chance to learn Russian. Was it clear to you then that you were heading into intelligence work, and what did you think of becoming an intelligence asset?
Well, my career was sort of unknown at the time when I was in London, there. And I went to a pub in Covent Garden. Of course, the story is, it's a big story of how this happened. Do you want me to go through Colombo?
Sure.
Okay. Well, after June the 12th, I was posted to the Far East, and I wound up at Ratmalana in Ceylon.
And so this is still during the Second World War?
No, this is after June the 12th, 45. I was commanding the staging post and the station at Ratmalana, which is part of the transportation from England right through to Australia.
Right.
I had a squadron, 232 squadron detachment of four liberators that flew from Ratmalana down to Australia.
Right.
But the others came in, and we would billet them, the crews, and we'd service them, and then they'd go back on their job. In October, I was told that I had to move the station up to Negumbo, which was had been built. And I'll mention why that was. Anyway, we had a steel link runway, and it had been there for a long, long time, and it was bad. So we had to close the station every day at 4 o'clock. And then the crews would come in and repair those links. And finally, it got to the stage where it was almost hopeless. So Negumbo Airfield had been built to handle the Lincoln, which at that time was the largest bomber in the Royal Air Force.
And where is Negumbo?
Negumbo is north of Colombo, about 25 miles.
In Ceylon?
Yeah, it's in Ceylon. It is now the international airport. It was the widest and longest airstrip in the whole of the RAF. And so I was told to move it, and on the 1st of December, I moved up, and we kept everything. I promised the airman, I had a meeting with the airman, and without any officers, and said, look, conditions are not good. We have no amenities for you, but we've got to move. But if you will maintain the aircraft, see everything except on time, then I will devote all my energies to getting things right for you. And so we did move, and all aircraft were on time and on schedule. Well, at that time, there was a great surplus of senior officers in the Far East. And they decided the headquarters in New Delhi decided that they better put a group captain in there. They had extra ones. So I was sent as wing commander flying in Dum Dum, much the same as when I was flight commander with 202 Squadron.
What's Dum Dum?
Same job.
Dum Dum?
Dum Dum, Calcutta.
Oh, in Calcutta, okay.
And I think I was there 4 or 5 days, and I got jaundice. And I was sick for 3 really bad weeks. Anyway, to cut a long story short, when I was okay, I got on a 53 Squadron aircraft, flew back down to Negumbo, and I heard that the Liberator was on its last trip. So I flew down with them to Perth in the west coast of Australia, and Guildford is the station there. And they used to have steak or big pork chops and eggs and chips and for breakfast, you know, the Australians. Anyway, we laid on the beach. So what we did, we put the aircraft unserviceable. It's in our last flight. And then I got a message. It said, return immediately. You have been posted back to Command Negumbo. And Air Chief Marshal Sir Keith Parks is coming to inspect. So we put it serviceable, flew back, And there I learned that the group captain, instead of following on where I had, because I hadn't met him, he started having his house built and a tennis court built. And the airmen were most distressed because they had their beer ration under their beds. You know, there was no cinema. They had no none of the ladies that run canteens or anything like that. The airmen at Karachi Airport, I'm talking now 1945, December. They said, the war's over. We want to go home. We don't want to be in this stinking place, you know. And Dum Dum, which was, you know, the hellhole of Calcutta. Well, Dum Dum was Calcutta. And through 53 Squadron, or 52 Squadron, I'm not sure, with the aircraft flying and the messages going, they decided they were going to do something about it.
They,
the airmen, decided that. I'm sorry. And so one day at Karachi, they decided to work to rule. At Calcutta, they wouldn't work at all. And at Negumbo, they wouldn't work at all. They went on strike.
These are Air Force people.
Royal Air Force people. And this is not very well known. Anyway, they got rid of the group captain right away. And I was brought back to look after the station. Charlie Slee, who was the group captain in charge of Dum Dum, was found at fault, and he was demoted to a wing commander. I got a call from headquarters in Delhi from the senior air staff officer, SASO, S-A-S-O, saying, George, look, Charlie Slee has been demoted. We can't send him home to England like this. And yours is the only wing commander station in the Far East. Would you be willing to let Charlie have your station and you can have anything else you want? So I said, sure. He said, well, what would you want? I said, I want 230 Squadron Sunderland in Singapore. He said, you've got it. So Charlie Slee came and he got off the aircraft and here he are. He's got one stripe missing. And you know, it stands out like a sore thumb.
Well, you could actually see that the...
Oh, yeah, because the rest of it has been in the sun and is blanched, bleached, I mean, you see. And he said, George, the only hat I have has got scrambled eggs on it. See, the group captain, unlike the services now, everybody has stuff on their hat. The group captain had the gold leaf on him. And he said, I can't wear that. Do you have a spare hat? I said, sure, Charlie, I've got one. If it'll fit you, you can have it. I've got an old one. So I went and got it. And he put it on, and it fitted him. And so I said my goodbyes and went off to Salita in Singapore.
Had you known Charlie Slee before that?
No, I had not. I had not. Now, to get the answer to your question.
Oh, yes.
Now, when I'm in London... Okay. When I'm in London, I used to go to Covent Garden pub for my lunch from Air Ministry. I was in Bush House in Aldwych. And I went there one day, and I was sitting down. We used to get steak and chips, you know, horse meat, but that's all right. And I had a seat vacant here, and a chap came and sat down beside me. And I turned around, and I said, hey, Charlie Slee, you know? I said, hi, George. So we sort of shot the breeze a bit. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm putting people in university. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we have to get more interpreters, so we're sending them to the university in London to learn Chinese and Japanese and Russian. I said, Russian? He said, yeah. I said, you know, ever since I was in the Soviet Union, I thought, what, how wonderful it would be. And I thought of it at the time, we had to use an interpreter, and I always thought, gee, I wish I could speak Russian. So I said, boy, that's wonderful. You send them to university to learn Russian. He said, yeah, school is of Slavonic languages and East European studies. He said, why, would you like to learn Russian? I said, yeah. He said, well, you get your CO's approval, and then you get the AOC's approval, then you get the AOC and C's approval, and then you take an aptitude test, and if you get through all those, maybe you can go to university. But he said, George, I owe you for a station, and I owe you for a hat. And when I get back, your name will go in the box, and you'll come up on the next course.
What goes around comes around.
That's a true story.
Wow. So did you realize that he was, in essence, hiring you not just to learn to speak Russian, but to do it?
Well, yeah, that's the follow on, you see. And of course, when personnel get a hold of this, he's in personnel, but when the posting has come, what are they going to do with me? So I had been demoted again because we got acting ranks in the war, you know. I was just a squadron leader. And
you're about 36 years old?
Yeah, I was 36, yeah. Anyway, they decided maybe I could try for your attaché. So I and my wife were invited to go and see the Assistant Chief of Air Staff for Intelligence, a chap named Air Vice Marshal McDonald. And he vetted us to see whether we were suitable to go into the diplomatic side. And at the end of the interview, he said, well, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't go into that at all if you would like to do that. And I said, sure.
So why was your wife interviewed for the diplomatic corps?
Because some of the wives can create havoc in embassies. You know, you either support it, you either represent, you're representing your country, you know. You either do it well or you don't. So they're very careful about wives. And anyway, so we were okay. So then I went to, I was told, and I went and I had to go, I think, within about 2 or 3 weeks then that the course started. So I went to university. And all day long, just nothing else but Russian. And mainly it was military stuff. And conversation was quite restricted. It was all grammar and composition and translation on military side. And so I managed to get through that. And then I was sent to Paris where I lived with Russian emigres. And I had three tutors. One was a Baroness Ixkura. That's UXKULLA, I think, whose sister had been the lady-in-waiting to the Tsarina. She was a sort of a very old Victorian lady with gray lace around her neck and everything.
Yeah.
Very strict. And I was given money for tutors, but she wouldn't take money from me. I had to put it in an envelope on the table so she didn't take money. And she grilled me in higher level Russian, particularly the accent and the stress, and in literature, and all things of the, sort of the fine art type of thing. And then I had a General Levitsky, General Kovalevsky, who I'd probably been a lieutenant in the Tsarist army, and he drove a taxi.
He drove a taxi now?
Yeah, he drove a taxi. But I got three lessons from him, each one I got three lessons a week. And we did Army, Air Force, and Navy, and geography.
Of the Soviet Union?
Of the Soviet Union, yeah. Okay. And then I had Professor Levitsky, who had been a professor at the University of Moscow just before the revolution, and he got out. And with him, I got politics and science and, you know, all the better things. So this, for 6 months, this went on, bing, 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 bing. And, of course, I didn't ever speak English. My wife came for 1 weekend, and when we woke up and I spoke to her in Russian, she came back. Anyway, I got my interpretership.
Uh-huh. So that, you became an interpreter?
Well, I would never...
Before you could be an attaché?
Well, in my case, yes. Yeah, in my case, yes. I did act as an interpreter sometimes, but basically I refused to be called an interpreter.
You were a senior officer.
Yeah, that's right. And you see, the Americans were trained in, when I went to Budapest, they were trained in Hungarian language, and they were trained in Monterey, and they lived there with their family.
In California.
In California. And they had a smattering. They really didn't have much at all. And so I was able to be good friends with the general, General Boyko, and his replacement, General Tikhonov, and the assistant military attaché. And I could talk to the Czechs and the Poles because they had been trained in the Soviet Union. So I could talk, and all the senior officers of the Hungarian Air Force, they talked Russian.
I think at this point, George, we're going to turn the tape over because we're at the end of the cycle.
We're back a cup of coffee.